This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Celeste Headley in Washington. The anxious eyes of world leaders are now focused on three areas. In Mali, the French continue their airstrikes in the northern part of the country in hopes of stopping the advance of armed Islamist rebels. In Syria, the death toll rises and the conflicts between the government and opposition enter what the International Rescue Committee calls a staggering humanitarian crisis. And in Afghanistan, questions about the ongoing transition of power remain as troops withdraw from that country and the threat of militant activity remains. All three countries have prompted debate over whether or not the U.S. needs presence there and why the conflicts matter to the American people. So if you talk with people in Mali, Syria, or Afghanistan, what are you hearing about what's going on? Is it different from what you hear in the news? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and then click on Talk of the Nation. Later on in the program, self-tracking technology. It's complicating even the most basic question of all, how are you? But first, what's at stake in Mali, Syria, and Afghanistan? J. Peter Pham is with the Atlantic Council, where he directs their Africa Center. He also serves on the senior advisory group of the U.S. Africa Command. He joins me here in Studio 3A. And also with me in studio is NPR's Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman. Thanks to both of you for being here with me.
Good to be with you. Pleasure.
And also with us from member station KUOG in Norman, Oklahoma, Joshua Landis, associate professor and director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He also runs the blog Syria Comment. Josh, nice to talk to you again.
How are you, Celeste? Good to be here.
So let me begin with you, Peter. Let's begin in Mali. The French government has said they will increase the number of troops that they send there. What's the current state of the conflict?
Well, the French deployment last week and the bombing runs that they've had over rebel positions have stopped an offensive that the Islamist rebels who have controlled the northern two-thirds of Mali since last spring were making into government-held southern Mali. However, at the same time, the Islamists have shown that it's a whack-a-mole situation. Overnight, a different column of Islamists went bypass the French and Malian government positions and came to within 200 miles of the Bamako, the Malian capital. They're not going to be able to hold that town that they took, Yabali, but they made their point that the deployment so far has not been sufficient to stop them and, in fact, may have stirred them up.
You've had a lot of criticism for the French intervention into what's going on in Mali in terms of whether or not it could be successful. And yet, if no one intervenes, what happens?
Well, let's be clear about a couple of things, Celeste. First, the presence of the Islamists in northern Mali is a security threat.
For the world.
For the world. And especially for the countries in the region. And we cannot forget the people who are having this brutal Islamist rule foisted upon them. Brutal amputations, stonings, floggings, destruction of centuries-old Muslim shrines. All this is taking place, not unlike Afghanistan before 9/11, one might say. But all that being said, the threat could have been contained because the threat really grows out of a pathology in Malian society, a crisis that's political, social, as well as security, and it cannot be sustainably solved with purely military means.
Meaning that diplomatic means have to be brought to bear, even though the government that's in the capital of Mali right now is not the elected government.
And that's part of the problem. The French have intervened in support of a government that's not an elected government. And there's been no progress made and no incentives made or pressure to reform that situation. So without a legitimate government in Mali, you're not going to get anyone rallying to the colors to fight for an illegitimate government. You're not going to be able to put proposals on the table that are credible to people who might be peeled away from the Islamists. And then the neighboring countries themselves are hesitant. They've put together a supposed plan that was approved by the UN Security Council last month to deploy 3,300 African troops. But 3,300 troops to take an area the size of France, the size of Texas, it's delusional at best, and possibly a very sick joke on the poor soldiers who'd be sent there.
That's Peter Pham, who's with the Atlantic Council. Let me ask direct a question to our Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman. I mean, some of the Islamist groups that are in the northern part of Mali have ties to some people who've threatened the United States. In fact, they may be tied to the group that assassinated the U.S. ambassador in Libya. What is the appetite in the Pentagon for intervening in Mali?
Well, there's no appetite in the Pentagon for intervening in Mali. They will offer, it looks like, the French some sort of assistance. The French need a cargo aircraft, C-130s and other aircraft that would carry French troops and supplies into Mali. They're also looking for refueling planes for French warplanes. And they're also looking for intelligence gear, basically either satellite imagery of some of these locations in the northern part of Mali or signals intelligence intercepts of some of the, radio and phone conversations. But, they've repeatedly said there'll be no U.S. troops on the ground here. And it looks like, the American military was somewhat taken by surprise by the French going in so quickly. Just last month, General Carter Hamm, who heads African Command, was in Washington speaking at George Washington University. He talked a lot about Mali, about the concerns about the groups there with ties to al-Qaeda. And there's really a rim around the northern part of Africa with a lot of terrorist groups, al-Qaeda affiliates up there. And General Hamm was talking about how they're all coming together. They're sharing information, weapons, and tactics. And there's a real concern there about them just kind of, coordinating much more than they did in the past. But it was interesting when General Hamm was here, he talked about hopefully some sort of a negotiated settlement in Mali, and maybe, possibly, there would have to be some type of military intervention. He talked about the French taking a lead here.
A NATO intervention.
He talked about France assisting an African-led operation at that time. And the Americans may or may not help, maybe some logistics help, like I just mentioned. But the sense we got when General Hamm was here was this is down the road a bit. Some talked about maybe even into the fall of this year. And all of a sudden, we see the French jumping into Mali quickly and now calling for U.S. support.
All right. Well, let me turn to Joshua Landis, turn away from Mali for just a moment and talk about Syria. Maybe you could give us a quick update on Syria as well. I mean, we know that the casualties are rising. Where does that conflict stand?
Well, the big debate is how long is this going to go on? And many people, me included, have suggested that it could go on into 2014. The death rate is well above 60,000 people so far. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians have fled out of the country and are in these terrible camps, particularly the ones in Jordan, which are underfunded. There was just flooding weather that swept away many people in the camp, and they had to pull back, get their tents up again. It's freezing cold. Yeah. There's snow in some of these camps. There's no money. And the country is locked in this brutal conflict. Bashar al-Assad the president of Syria, gave a major speech the other day in which he said, he called the opposition terrorists. He said he would speak to people who did not have blood on their hands and that they could have some dialogue. But anybody who had been fighting, he said, are terrorists and they're agents of foreign countries, and he's going to destroy them. So he was pretty unbending in the opposition.
Meaning, Joshua, that all of the diplomatic outreach to him has done nothing. I mean, he basically said, I will stay here, period. I'm not going anywhere.
Right. Yes, he has said he was born in Syria and he's going to die in Syria. And the opposition, for their part, for the most part, say that they're not going to have any dialogue with Bashar al-Assad except for about how long the rope is going to be that's going to hang him. So he's under no illusions that he's going to, he's going to fight to the end. And his system, his regime is very brittle. It's very narrow at the top. If the family goes, the regime probably falls apart. He knows that. And there are about 2.34 million Alawites who could face revenge if this regime collapses. And in the meantime, the Sunni majority is being just pummeled with this Air Force. And it begs the question of, you know, should America go in and take out the Air Force or get involved in Syria?
Well, let me direct
that. That's the big question.
Yeah, and that's the question I have. And again, the same question here, but this time in Syria. What is the appetite on the part of the American military? You're shaking your head already, Tom Bowman. Any possibility of military intervention?
The same appetite they have about Mali. They don't want to get dragged into Syria. And one of the reasons is they look at the ethnic makeup of the country, and military officials you talk with privately say, do you see any connection here? It's similar to that of Iraq. And what happened when we went into Iraq? We threw out that government, and then we spent a decade there trying to rebuild the place. So there's no appetite for intervening in Syria. So what the military has done so far is offer humanitarian assistance in Turkey, in Jordan, and also what they call non-lethal assistance to the rebel groups, communications equipment, radios, and so forth. No arms at all at this point. And, you know, there is a lot of talk about what can the U.S. do? Could they basically, you know, create a no-fly zone? But as Defense Secretary Robert Gates mentioned before the Libyan operation, you have to understand creating a no-fly zone means going to war because you're taking out radar, you're taking out missile defenses and so forth. The problem for the military is that Syria has one of the strongest air defense systems in the world, maybe third to Russia and China, they say. So it took weeks, if not months, in Libya to take that government down. They say it would be as long, if not longer, to deal with that situation in Syria. The big concern for the U.S. military and some of the allies in the region are the chemical weapons that Assad has. He has tons of sarin agent, the nerve agent, and they're worried about that either being used against the population, against the rebels, or frankly, what's more concerning is that stuff leaking out of the country and getting into the wrong hands. Wrong hands, of course, meaning
Al
Qaeda.
Someone picks it up who shouldn't.
The other concern they have, we can talk about it.
Yeah, well, we'll go right back. Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll have more with my guests, Peter Pham from the Atlantic Council, Joshua Landis, director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and NPR's Pentagon correspondent, Tom Bowman. We want to hear from you. If you talk with people in Mali, Syria, or Afghanistan, what are you hearing about what's going on? 800-989-8255, or send us an email, talk@npr.org. I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Celeste Headlee in Washington. Mali, Syria, Afghanistan. Three countries enduring various levels of conflict. In Mali, a French-led bombing campaign may soon be followed by troops on the ground. In Syria, deadly explosions at the main university in Aleppo are just the latest violence in a war that's been raging for nearly 2 years now. In Afghanistan, the role of U.S. troops going forward is still uncertain. Today, we've invited our guests, Peter Pham, director of the Africa Center at the Atlantic Council, Joshua Landis of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and Tom Bowman, Pentagon correspondent for NPR, to talk about what's at stake. And we want to hear from you, especially if you hear from people in one of these countries, Mali, Syria, or Afghanistan. What are you hearing about what's going on? Is it different from the media coverage you hear? 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And right now we have a phone call from Zach in Damascus. What are you hearing from people in, I guess, Syria?
Excuse me, you know, I need to clarify, that's Damascus, Oregon, not Damascus,
right,
Syria. Yes. I would say I'm hearing about the exact opposite that's being told on the radio.
In what way?
As far as the violence and the terrorism that's going on. I think just at my mother's house a half hour ago, she told me, I think there's about 100 people who were gunned down in the line to buy bread. This just happened yesterday. And also recently there is an old Crusaders castle. It's called El Hessen. I think in French it's called Crac des Chevaliers. And right now it's besieged by Islamic terrorists. And the army has surrounded it. And this is actually pretty close to a lot of the Christian villages in the area. They have surrounded, but they have refused to fire on it because it's a national historic monument. Mm-hmm. So their plan is pretty much just hold out as long as it takes. That hopefully they'll run out of food and simply surrender with no bloodshed.
Zach, are you wishing that the U.S. or NATO or the U.N. would intervene?
The problem with that is everybody needs to know. I mean, changes need to happen, but the way they're going about it with terrorism does not work. So when the U.S. wants to intervene, it just concerns me that they just want to put up a government, which they don't really fully understand their agenda and so forth. And it's a lot of the Christian seculars that are afraid in that country because they don't want to live under Islamic law. The women there right now are afforded many, many rights. In my opinion, not even close to what they should be. Of course, me living in America, but they're especially afraid. You know, women can go to college. They can fly airplanes. They can drive cars. And all of that life would come to an end, and everybody there knows it. And that's one of the biggest fears of all.
Okay, thank you so much. That's Zach calling from Damascus, Oregon. Let me get your response to the things that Joshua said there. I mean, to the things that Zach said, Joshua.
Well, it's true that the United States has been spooked by the rebels that they are allied with. And many of the there are at least 1,000 militias in Syria today that have emerged. There are numbers that are quite big. There are a lot of little ones. But many of the most competent militias, like Jabhat al-Nusra, which is allied with al-Qaeda and was recently proscribed by the U.S., called it a terrorist organization, they're the best fighters. And often they're seen as the most honest militias because, like Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they have not stolen from people. They've understood that the way to win hearts and minds is to set up soup kitchens and to try to be honest with people. And so increasingly, these Islamic militias, some of them quite Salafist, are winning the popularity game. And many of the more secular militias are turning out to be not so good. So the United States is confused about what to do because they want to destroy the Assad government. But most of the minorities, the Christians, and I could tell that your caller was very worried about what's going to happen to Christians and these minorities in Syria once the Sunnis win. And so I think America has been paralyzed in a sense. They want to destroy Assad because he's a friend of Iran and he's been an enemy of Israel. But at the same time, they don't really want the rebel militias to win. And they're worried about the chemical weapons getting into their hands. And so I think America has become paralyzed. And many people in the region believe that America has abandoned them.
Well, let's move to Mali, because that's what this caller here, Jeff, in Madison, Wisconsin, was talked about. Jeff, you lived in Mali for a while, right?
I was a Peace Corps volunteer 1,000 years ago, but had occasion to return just last year with the United Nations. I was there, it's a year now, it was last March. I was there literally 4 days before the coup in Bamako and left just before it. While there, I had dinner with a Malian friend who's been in the government for a long time, not in security part of the government, but another part of the government. And he told me quite unequivocally that the Malian military would never be able to defeat these northern fighters. This was 4 days before the coup in Bamako, so 4 days before the Malian military shot itself in the foot, before it was divided by this coup. So he was saying even when it was still an institution somewhat together, it was impossible that they would be able to defeat these northerners. The outside intervention, I hate to say it, is likely the only way things will be changed there. It's highly unlikely that West African countries, although there's a lot of talk about that in the media, will be able to send forces to do anything constructive. They do not have the experience fighting in those conditions. Probably the only ones who do are the Chadians, and they're unlikely to send anybody just because of internal reasons. So it is external, unfortunately, outside intervention that would change things there. The French have started it. I have no idea where it's going, but that was
just my... Well, let me put that question, Jeff, for you. Thank you very much. That's Jeff calling from Madison, Wisconsin, who clearly pays very close attention to what's going on in Mali. But let me put that to you, Peter Pham. Your response to Jeff saying that there has to be outside intervention.
Well, I think Jeff's points are very well made. I would add to it, not only was the Malian military ineffectual before the coup, but the political establishment itself was becoming increasingly rotten from dirty money coming in, from drug smuggling. In fact, some members of the government that was overthrown were actually in business with the Islamists, encouraging them because they were business partners in narco trafficking. That's how bad the situation has become, which is why it will take time. It would take time to rebuild the Malian military, but in order to do that, you have to rebuild a government people will trust in, will fight for. And that time is required. And he's absolutely right. The West African have not stepped up to the plate here. The plan they put forward is not a realistic plan. However, that's if we want African-led, that's what we're going to get. So yeah. The question is going to be the political will. France has stepped in, but unfortunately, they don't seem to have the wherewithal to finish what they started. And now the pressure is going to be on other members of NATO and other partners to do something, because France's timetable that the French government is still speaking about is really not serious. The timetable, we'll be gone in a few weeks. They're actually going in. They've got 750 troops on the ground now. They're saying they're going to bring it up to 2,000. That's not enough to retake the north. But they also can't leave. The African troops will not be ready to deploy any time in the next few weeks.
Doesn't that sound familiar to anyone who's covered Afghanistan? I mean, there is one other big elephant in the room here, which is the longest war the United States has ever been into. We have to talk about Afghanistan. It's what our next caller wants to talk about is Paul in Sun Valley, Idaho. And Paul, you actually have a brother serving in Afghanistan right now.
I've got a brother who's a POW, too. His name is Bo. Where is he? You know, what Hegelian principles have we started across the world, and why are things working out so bad to secure a pivot for a pipeline? How can you fight an enemy when he's really not there?
This is the problem anyway. I mean, this the problem with all of these three conflicts that we're talking about, Tom Bowman, let me put this to you, is I said earlier that there's a common thread here, extremism and terrorism. This is one of the reasons that NATO might be interested. It's one of the reasons the United States might be interested in these conflicts. And it appears to me, correct me if I'm wrong, that very often the strategy of extremist groups is they find a government that's weak in a nation where perhaps the citizens don't have a lot of resources, and they try to establish a home base. It is like whack-a-mole.
That's right, and that's a concern they have, particularly in Africa with some of these areas. As General Carter Ham said, the head of African Command, he's worried about this rim of states in northern Africa and some of these terrorist al-Qaeda affiliates coming together, organizing, sharing information and weapons, and having this whole part of Africa just become basically a huge failed state region. But, you know, if you look at Syria, if you look at Mali, if you look at Afghanistan, in some respects, you know, they have parallels that you basically have a government that people don't trust or a failed government, and you have to rebuild the military. I mean, something you're seeing in Afghanistan right now. The reason you have insurgencies is because you have a government that's either non-existent or predatory, or just, you know, just isn't there for people. That's what we're seeing both Mali and Afghanistan. You still don't have a lot of support for the Afghan government. That's one of the particular problems with building security forces in the country and getting your average person in the country to support the Karzai government, which is widely viewed as ineffectual and corrupt. Now, of course, Syria is a different story.
Yeah.
You have a government that's, you know...
The United States supported heavily.
Absolutely. Supportive, yeah, for a long time. And now you have a huge effort to oust the Assad government. And the United States, rather than wanting to intervene, is basically looking to Russia to help out in this situation.
Both Russia and China are remaining obstructionist in the UN Security Council.
And so, as a result... People I talk with at the Pentagon say things are going to get worse before they get better.
Let me go back to you, Joshua Landis, because I'm interested in what the caller, Zach, said about the fact that he is not sure Syrians would want any outside intervention. This is something we've heard argued between Syrians. Do they need outside help? Do they not? What do you think? Is it more like the caller said about Mali, that at some point there has to be outside intervention, whether it be the Arab League or somewhere else, in order to resolve it?
You know, Syrians are very divided, and unfortunately, Syria, like most of these other countries we're talking about, is not really a nation. There are many different groups. They have very starkly different ideas on what they want to see for their country, and that is at the heart of the problem. That's why it's crumbled, and that's why the opposition in Syria is so fragmented and hard to help in many ways. But there is a large section of the middle class in Syria that would pray for anybody today to put boots on the ground and to provide them with food and electricity and just some safety, because the country is falling apart. The economy has collapsed by half. There are 24 million, 23 million people trapped there. And they're beginning to starve to death. There's no electricity. They're freezing. There's no heating oil. It is, you know, we are seeing a failed state, you know, just popping up in front of us. And there's going to be millions of people. There are already 500,000 people who fled. There's almost 2 million displaced internally. But many of those people are going to begin to flee out of Syria, particularly as this winter goes on and there's no food. So, you know, unfortunately, I fear what we're getting to a certain extent. There's been a lot of good news in the world in the sense that China, India, the BRIC countries are growing at close to 10%. It's extraordinary. But there are countries that aren't making it. And we're adding about a billion people on this earth in the next decade. And the competition for resources is phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, and we know how commodity prices have been screaming up, whether it's oil, whether it's wheat, many other things. It's becoming more expensive to live, and there's a lot more competition. And the countries that have ineffective governments that cannot provide and that that don't have growth rates that can keep up with this are going to turn into failed states. And I think we're going to see what we saw in the Arab Spring, I think we're going to see is just the canary in the mine shaft to a certain degree. We're going to see this with other African and Middle Eastern countries that just cannot make it economically.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Well, let me bring this back to you then, Peter Pham. How much of this do you recognize when he's speaking of Syria? How much of this is also true of Mali? If there is no outside intervention, if the military there is not able to cope with this, if the government is not stable enough to cope with it, then what?
Well, I think the international community, and in particular the United States, needs to ask itself the question, which, by the way, the French did not address in their intervention. What are the objectives? What are our national security interests? Certainly the national security interests of the United States and France in Mali and by, linkage analogy, perhaps Afghanistan, certainly to prevent an extremist from gathering and creating a safe haven. But is it necessarily to also that objective is limited and can be achieved? But does it require restoring Mali's territorial integrity? Does it require getting a constitutional order back in place in Bamako? And if one is being frank, and this has to be part of the dialogue and conversation, we can secure our security interests. We can prevent northern Mali from being a safe haven without necessarily putting Mali back together again.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's bring it back as we begin to close this conversation to Afghanistan. We have a call here from Wolfgang in Princeton, New Jersey, and you wanted to talk about the long war in Afghanistan.
Yes. Good afternoon. The issue, what I hear from Kabul and what I've lived there and in Mazar-e-Sharif, is that our ongoing discussion about an accelerated withdrawal and the withdrawal, what the Afghans experienced already by the French and by other ISAF members, has unbelievable economic ramifications. And that is that any even weak direct foreign investment or, you know, other international initiatives on a private base to build up new businesses is basically dying off now. And people pack up and leave and or stop their programs. And the worst, what was not discussed at all in our ongoing debates here in the States and in other ISAF members, is that the PRTs, the provincial reconstruction teams, which have been in 30 or 40 odd cases, major investment vehicles are stopping and shutting down office. And so it leads to an even more far-ranging unemployment and really despair on the behalf of many of the young Afghans.
Which is understandable. That's Wolfgang calling from Princeton, New Jersey. Let me give the last minute to you, Tom Bowman. Maybe Afghanistan is what in some way also makes the United States and other countries hesitant to intervene in a place like Mali or Syria.
Oh, absolutely. And clearly, you know, the United States signed a 10-year security agreement with the Afghan government. So there will be some presence, a certain amount of money sent to Afghanistan in the coming years. But there's absolutely no question that the Obama administration wants to, you know, fairly quickly move out the bulk of the U.S. forces, have some sort of a small mission there. You're not going to see the kind of money thrown around that we've seen in the past 10 years, and that could have a huge ripple effect across the economy and a brain drain. A lot of young people basically saying, I'm getting out while I can.
That was NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. He was here with me in Studio 3A, as was Peter Pham with the Atlantic Council. He also serves on the Senior Advisory Group of the U.S. Africa Command. And Josh Landis joined us as well, Associate Professor and Director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Oklahoma. He runs the blog Syria Comment, and he joined us from member station KGOU in Norman, Oklahoma. Thanks to all three of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
After a short break, we'll talk about all the ways we break down our days into hours of deep sleep, steps walked, calories consumed, the quantified self. Stay with us. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.